play a perfect symphony in their respective calling. Just as a pianist may play any tune when once the keyboard of the piano and the fundamentals of music have been mastered. No two people on earth are exactly alike, and for this reason, no two people would be expected to attain from this course the same viewpoint. Each student should read the course, understand it, and then appropriate from its contents whatever he or she needs to develop a well-rounded personality. Before this appropriation can be properly made, it will be necessary for the student to analyze himself. Through the use of the questionnaire that comes with the 16th lesson of the course, for the purpose of finding out what his deficiencies may be. This questionnaire should not be filled out until the student thoroughly masters the content of the entire course, for he will then be in a position to answer the questions with more accuracy and understanding of himself. Through the aid of this questionnaire, an experienced character analyst can take inventory of one's faculties as easily and as accurately as a merchant can inventory the goods on his shelves. This course has been compiled for the purpose of helping the student find out what are his and her natural talents, and for the purpose of helping organize, coordinate, and put into use the knowledge gained from this experience. For more than 20 years, I have been gathering, classifying, and organizing the material that has gone into this course. During the past 14 years, I have analyzed more than 16,000 men and women, and all of the vital facts gathered from these analysts have been carefully organized and woven into this course. These analyses brought out many interesting facts which have helped to make this course practical and usable. For example, it was discovered that 95% of all who were analyzed were failures, and but 5% were successes. By the term failure is meant that they had failed to find happiness and the ordinary necessities of life without struggle, that was almost unbearable. Perhaps this is about the proportion of successes and failures that might be found if all the people of the world were accurately analyzed. The struggle for a mere existence is terrific among people who have not learned how to organize and direct their natural talents. While the attainment of those necessities, as well as the acquiring of many of the luxuries, is comparatively simple among those who have mastered the principle of organized effort. One of the most startling facts brought to light by these 16,000 analyses was the discovery that the 95% who were classed as failures were in that class because they had no definite chief aim in life. While the 5% constituting the successful ones not only had purposes that were definable, but they had also definite plans for the attainment of their purpose. Another important fact disclosed by these analyses was that the 95% constituting the failures were engaged in work in which they did not like, while the 5% constituting the successful ones were doing that which they liked best. It is doubtful whether a person could be a failure while engaged in work which he liked best. Another vital fact learned from the analysis was that all of the 5% who were succeeding had formed the habit of systematic saving of money, while the 95% were failures saved nothing. This is worthy of serious thought. One of the chief objects of this course is to aid the student in performing his or her chosen work in such a manner that it will yield the greatest return in both money and happiness. A definite chief aim. The keynote of this entire lesson may be found in the word definite. It is most appalling to know that 95% of the people of the world are drifting aimlessly through life, without the slightest conception of the work for which they are best suited, and with no conception whatsoever of even the need of such a thing as a definite objective toward which to strive. There is a psychological as well as an economic reason for the selection of a definite chief aim in life. Let us devote our attention to the psychological side of the question first. It is a well-established principle of psychology that a person's acts are always in harmony with the dominating thought of his or her mind. Any definite chief aim that is deliberately fixed in the mind and held there with the determination to realize it, finally saturates the entire subconscious mind until it automatically influences the physical action of the body toward the attainment of that purpose. Your definite chief aim in life should be selected with deliberate care, and after it has been selected, it should be written out and placed where you will see it at least once a day. The psychological effect of such is to impress this purpose upon your subconscious mind so strongly that it accepts that purpose as a pattern or blueprint that will eventually dominate your activities in life and lead you, step by step, toward the attainment of the object back of that purpose. The principle of psychology through which you can impress your definite chief aim upon your subconscious mind is called autosuggestion, or suggestion which you repeatedly make to yourself. It is a degree of self-hypnotism, but do not be afraid of it on that account, for it was this same principle through the aid of which Napoleon lifted himself from the lowly station of poverty-stricken Corsican to the dictator of France. It was through the aid of this same principle that Thomas Edison has risen from the lowly beginning of a news butcher to where he is accepted as the leading inventor of the world. It was through the aid of this same principle that Lincoln bridged the mighty chasm between his lowly birth in a log cabin in the mountains of Kentucky and the presidency of the greatest nation on earth. It was through the aid of this same principle that Theodore Roosevelt became one of the most aggressive leaders that ever reached the presidency of the United States. You need have no fear of the principle of autosuggestion as long as you are sure that the objective for which you are striving is one that will bring you happiness of an enduring nature. Be sure that your definite purpose is constructive, that its attainment will bring hardship and misery to no one, that it will bring you peace and prosperity. Then apply to the limit of your understanding the principle of self-suggestion for the speedy attainment of this purpose. On the street corner, just opposite the room in which I am writing, I see a man who stands there all day long and sells peanuts. He is busy every minute. When not actually engaged in making a sale, he is roasting and packing the peanuts in little bags. He is one of the great army constituting the 95% who have no definite purpose in life. He is selling peanuts, not because he likes that work better than anything else he might do, but because he never sat down and thought out a definite purpose that would bring him greater returns for his labor. He is selling peanuts because he is a drifter on the sea of life, and one of the tragedy of his work is the fact that the same amount of effort that he puts into it, if directed along other lines, would bring him much greater returns. Another one of the tragedy of this man's work is the fact that he is unconsciously making use of the principle of self-suggestion, but he is doing it in his own disadvantage. No doubt, if a picture could be made of this thought, there would be nothing in that picture except a peanut roaster, some little peanut bags, and a crowd of people buying peanuts. This man could get out of the peanut business if he had the vision and the ambition first to imagine himself in a more profitable calling, and the perseverance to hold that picture before his mind until it influenced him to take the necessary steps to enter a more profitable calling. He puts sufficient labor into his work to bring him a substantial return if that labor were directed toward the attainment of a definite purpose that offered bigger returns. One of my closest personal friends is one of the best-known writers and public speakers of this country. About 10 years ago, he caught sight of the possibilities of this principle of self-suggestion and began immediately to harness it and put it to work. He worked out a plan for its application that proved to be very effective. At that time, he was neither a writer nor a speaker. Each night, just before going to sleep, he would shut his eyes and see, in his imagination, a long council table at which he placed, in his imagination, certain well-known men whose characteristics he wished to absorb into his own personality. At the end of the table, he placed Lincoln, and on either side of the table, he placed Napoleon, Washington, Emerson, and Albert Hubbard. He then proceeded to talk to these imaginary figures that he had seated at his imaginary council table, something after this manner. "Mr. Lincoln, I desire to build in my own character those qualities of patience and fairness toward all mankind and the keen sense of humor which were your outstanding characteristics. I need these qualities, and I shall not be contented until I have developed them. Mr. Washington, I desire to build in my own character those qualities of patriotism and self-sacrifice and leadership which were your outstanding characteristics. Mr. Emerson, I desire to build in my own character those qualities of vision and the ability to interpret the laws of nature as written in the rocks of prison walls and growing trees and flowering brooks and growing flowers and the faces of little children, which were your outstanding characteristics. Napoleon, I desire to build in my own character those qualities of self-reliance and the strategic ability to master obstacles and profit by mistakes and develop strength out of defeat, which were your outstanding characteristics. Mr. Hubbard, I desire to develop the ability to equal and even to excel the ability that you possessed with which to express yourself in clear, concise, and forceful language. Night after night for many months, this man saw these men seated around the imaginary council table until finally he had imprinted their outstanding characteristics upon his own subconscious mind so clearly that he began to develop a personality which was a composite of their personalities. The subconscious mind may be likened to a magnet, and when it has been vitalized and thoroughly saturated with any definite purpose, it has a decided tendency to attract all that is necessary for the fulfillment of that purpose. Like attracts like, and you may see evidence of this law in every blade of grass and every growing tree. The acorn attracts from the soil and the air the necessary materials out of which to grow an oak tree. It never grows a tree that is part oak and part poplar. Every grain of wheat that is planted in the soil attracts the materials out of which to grow a stalk of wheat. It never makes a mistake and grows both oats and wheat at the same stalk. And men are subject also to the same law of attraction. Go into any cheap boarding house district in a city, and there you will find people of the same general trend of mind associated together. On the other hand, go into any prosperous community, and there you will find people of the same general tendencies associated together. Men who are successful always seek the company of others who are successful, while men who are on the ragged side of life always seek the company of those who are in the similar circumstances. Misery loves company. Water seeks its level with no finer certainty than man seeks the company of those who occupy his own general status, financially and mentally. A professor of Yale University and an illiterate hobo have nothing in common. They would be miserable if thrown together for any great length of time. Oil and water will mix as readily as will men who have nothing in common. All of which leads up to this statement, that you will attract people to you, people who harmonize with your own philosophy of life, whether you wish it or not. This being true, can you not see the importance of vitalizing your mind with a definite chief aim that will attract to you people who will be of help to you and not a hindrance? Suppose your definite chief aim is far above your present station in life. What of it? It is your privilege, nay, your duty, to aim high in life. You owe it to yourself and to the community in which you live to set a high standard for yourself. There is much evidence to justify the belief that nothing within reason is beyond the possibility of attainment by the man whose definite chief aim has been well developed. Some years ago, Louis Victor Eitan was given a life sentence in the Arizona penitentiary. At the time of his imprisonment, he was an all-around bad man, according to his own admission. In addition to this, it was believed that he would die of tuberculosis within a year. Eitan had reason to feel discouraged, if anybody ever had. Public feeling against him was intense, and he did not have a single friend in the world who came forth and offered him encouragement or help. Then something happened in his own mind that gave him back his health, put the dreaded white plague to rout, and finally unlocked the prison gates and gave him his freedom. What was that something? Just this. He made up his mind to whip the white plague and regain his health. That was a very definite chief aim. In less than a year from the time the decision was made, he had won. Then he extended the definite chief aim by making up his mind to gain his freedom. Soon the prison walls melted from around him. No undesirable environment is strong enough to hold the man or woman who understands how to apply the principle of autosuggestion in the creation of a definite chief aim. Such a person can throw off the shackles of poverty, destroy the most deadly disease germs, rise from a lowly station in life to power and plenty. All great leaders base their leadership upon a definite chief aim. Followers are willing followers when they know that their leader is a person with a definite chief aim who has the courage to back up that purpose with action. Even a bulky horse knows when a driver with a definite chief aim takes hold of the reins and yields to that driver. When a man with a definite chief aim starts through a crowd, everyone stands aside and makes a way for him. But let a man hesitate and show by his actions that he is not sure which way he wants to go, and the crowd will step all over his toes and refuse to budge an inch out of his way. Nowhere is the lack of definite chief aim more noticeable or more detrimental than it is in the relationship between parent and child. Children sense very quickly the wavering attitude of their parents and take advantage of that attitude quite freely. It is the same all through life. Men with a definite chief aim command respect and attention at all times. So much for the psychological viewpoint of the definite purpose. Let us now turn to the economic side of the question. If a steamship lost its rudder in mid-ocean and began circling around, it would soon exhaust its fuel supply without reaching shore, despite the fact that it would use up enough energy to carry it to shore and back several times. The man who labors without a definite purpose that is backed up by a definite plan for its attainment resembles the ship that has lost its rudder. Hard labor and good intentions are not sufficient to carry a man through to success. For how many a man be sure that he has attained success unless he has established in his mind some definite object that he wishes? Every well-built house started in the form of a definite purpose, plus a definite plan in the nature of the set of blueprints. Imagine what would happen if one tried to build a house by the haphazard method without plans. Workmen would be in each other's ways. Building material would be piled all over the lot before the foundation was completed, and everybody on the job would have a different notion as to how the house ought to be built. Result, chaos, and misunderstandings and costs that would be prohibited. Yet, had you ever stopped to think that most people finish school, take up employment, or enter the trade or profession without the slightest conception of anything that even remotely resembles a definite purpose or a definite plan? In view of the fact that science has provided reasonably accurate ways and means of analyzing character and determining the life work for which people are best fitted, does it not seem a modern tragedy that 95% of the adult population of the world is made up of women and men who are failures because they have not found their proper niches in the world's work? If success depends upon power, and if power is organized effort, and if the first step in the direction of organization is a definite purpose, then one may easily see why such a purpose is essential. Until a man selects a definite purpose in life, he dissipates his energy and spreads his thoughts over so many subjects and in so many different directions that they lead not to power, but to indecision and weakness. With the aid of a small reading glass, you can teach yourself a great lesson on the value of organized effort. Through the use of such a glass, you can focus the sun's ray on a definite spot so strongly that they will burn a hole through a plank. Remove the glass, which represents the definite purpose, and the same rays of sun may shine on that same plank for a million years without burning it. 1,000 electric batteries, when properly organized and connected together with wires, will produce enough power to run a good-sized piece of machinery for several hours. But take those same cells singly, disconnected, and not one of them would exert enough energy to turn the machinery over once. The faculties of your mind might properly be likened to these dry cells. When you organize your faculties according to the plan laid down in the 16 lessons of this reading course on the Law of Success and direct them toward the attainment of a definite purpose in life, you then take advantage of the cooperative or accumulated principle out of which the power is developed, which is called organized effort. Andrew Carnegie's advice was this: place all your eggs in one basket and then watch the basket to see that no one kicks it over. By that advice, he meant, of course, that we should not dissipate any of our energies by engaging in sidelines. Carnegie was a sound economist, and he knew that most men would do well if they so harnessed and directed their energies that some one thing would be done well. When the plan back of this reading course was first born, I remember taking the first manuscript to a professor at the University of Texas, and in a spirit of enthusiasm, I suggested to him that I had discovered a principle that would be of aid to me in every public speech I delivered thereafter, because I would be better prepared to organize and marshal my thoughts. He looked at the outline of the 15 points for a few minutes, then turned to me and said, "Yes, your discovery is going to help you make better speeches, but that is not all it will do. It will help you become a more effective writer, for I have noticed in your previous writings a tendency to scatter your thoughts. For instance, if you started to describe a beautiful mountain yonder in the distance, you would be apt to sidetrack your description by calling attention to a beautiful bed of wild flowers, or a running brook, or a singing bird, detouring here and there, zigzag fashion, before finally arriving at the proper point from which to view the mountain. In the future, you are going to find it much less difficult to describe an object, whether you are speaking or writing, because your 15 points represent the very foundation of organization. A man who had no legs once met a man who was blind. To prove conclusively that the lame man was a man of vision, he proposed to the blind man that they form an alliance that would be of a great benefit to both. "You let me climb upon your back," said he to the blind man, "then I shall use your legs and you may use my eyes. Between the two of us, we will get along more rapidly." Out of allied effort comes greater power. This is a point that is worthy of much repetition, because it forms one of the most important parts of the foundation of this reading course. The great fortunes of the world have been accumulated through the use of this principle of allied effort. That which one man can accomplish single-handed during an entire lifetime is but meager at best, no matter how well organized that man may be. But that which one man may accomplish through the principle of alliance with other men is practically without limitation. That mastermind to which Carnegie referred during my interview with him was made up of more than a score of minds. In that group were men of practically every temperament and inclination. Each man was there to play a certain part, and he did nothing else. There was perfect understanding and teamwork between these men. It was Carnegie's business to keep harmony among them, and he did it wonderfully well. If you are familiar with the game of football, you know, of course, that the winning team is the one that best coordinates the efforts of its players. Teamwork is the thing that wins. It is the same in the great game of life. In your struggle for success, you should keep constantly in mind the necessity of knowing what it is that you want, of knowing precisely what is your definite purpose, and the value of the principle of organized effort in the attainment of that which constitutes your definite purpose. In a vague sort of way, nearly everyone has a definite purpose, namely, desire for money. But this is not a definite purpose within the meaning of the term, as it is used in this lesson. before your purpose can be considered definite, even though that purpose were the accumulation of money, you would have to reach a decision as to the precise method of through which you intend to accumulate that money. It would be insufficient for you to say that you would make money by going into some sort of business. You would have to decide just what line of business. You would also have to decide just where you would locate. You would also have to decide the business policies under which you would conduct your business. In answering the question, what is your definite purpose in life? That appears in the questionnaire, which I have used for the analysis of more than 16,000 people. Many answered about as follows. My definite purpose in life is to be of as much service to the world as possible and earn a good living. That answer is about as definite as a frog's conception of the size of the universe is accurate. The object of this lesson is not to inform you as to what your life work should be, for indeed this could be done with accuracy only after you have been completely analyzed, but it is intended as a means of impressing upon your mind a clear conception of the value of a definite purpose of some nature, and of the value of understanding the principle of organized effort as a means of attaining the necessary power with which to materialize your definite purpose. Careful observation of the business philosophy of more than 100 men and women who have attained outstanding success in their respective callings disclosed the fact that each was a person of prompt and definite decision. The habit of working with a definite chief aim will breed you into the habit of prompt decision, and this habit will come to your aid in all that you do. Moreover, the habit of working with a definite chief aim will help you to concentrate all your attention on any given task until you have mastered it. Concentration of effort and the habit of working with a definite chief aim are two of the essential factors in success, which are always found together. One leads to the other. The best-known successful businessmen were all men of prompt decision who worked always with one main outstanding purpose as their chief aim. Some notable examples are as follows. Woolworth chose, as his definite chief aim, the creation of a chain of 5- and 10-cent stores that would cross America, and concentrated his mind upon this one task until he made it and it made him. Wrigley concentrated his mind on the production and sale of a 5-cent package of chewing gum and turned this one idea into millions of dollars. Edison concentrated upon the work of harmonizing natural laws and made his efforts uncover more useful inventions than any other man who ever lived. Henry Doherty concentrated upon the building and operation of public utility plants and made himself a multimillionaire. Ingersoll concentrated on a dollar watch and girdled the earth with tickers and made this one idea yield him a fortune. Statler concentrated on home-like hotel service and made himself wealthy as well as useful to millions of people who use his service. Edwin C. Barnes concentrated on the sale of Edison dictating machines and retired while still a young man with more money than he needs. Woodrow Wilson concentrated his mind on the White House for 25 years and became its chief tenant thanks to his knowledge of the value of sticking to a definite chief aim. Lincoln concentrated his mind on freeing the slaves and became our greatest American president while doing it. Martin Littleton heard a speech which filled him with a desire to become a great lawyer, concentrated his mind on that one aim, and is now said to be the most successful lawyer in America, whose fees for a single case seldom fall below $50,000. Rockefeller concentrated on oil and became the richest man of his generation. Ford concentrated on flivvers and made himself the richest and most powerful man who ever lived. Carnegie concentrated on steel and made his efforts build a great fortune and plastered his name on public libraries throughout America. Gillette concentrated on a safety razor, gave the entire world a close shave, and made himself a multimillionaire. George Eastman concentrated on the Kodak and made the idea yield him a fortune while bringing much pleasure to millions of people. Russell Conwell concentrated on one simple lecture acres of diamonds and made the idea yield more than $6 million. Hearst concentrated on sensational newspapers and made the idea worth millions of dollars. Helen Keller concentrated on learning to speak and, despite the fact that she was deaf, dumb, and blind, realized her definite chief aim. John Patterson concentrated on cash registers and made himself rich and others careful. The late Kaiser of Germany concentrated on war and got a big dose of it. Let us not forget the fact. Fleischmann concentrated on the humble little cake of yeast and made things hump themselves all over the world. Marshall Field concentrated on the world's greatest retail store, and lo, it rose before him a reality. Philip Armour concentrated on the butchering business and established a great industry, as well as a huge fortune. Millions of people are concentrating daily on poverty and failure and getting both in overabundance. Wright brothers concentrated on the airplane and mastered the air. Pullman concentrated on the sleeping car, and the idea made him rich and millions of people comfortable in travel. The Anti-Saloon League concentrated on the Prohibition Amendment, and whether for better or worse, made it a reality. Thus it will be seen that all who succeed work with some definite, outstanding aim as the object of their labor. There is some one thing that you can do better than anyone else in the world could do it. Search until you find out what this particular line of endeavor is. Make it the object of your definite chief aim, and then organize all of your forces and attack it with the belief that you are going to win. In your search for the work for which you are best fitted, it will be well if you bear in mind the fact that you will be most likely attaining the greatest success by finding out what work you like best. For it is a well-known fact that a man generally best succeeds in the particular line of endeavor in which he can throw his whole heart and soul. Let us go back, for the sake of clarity and emphasis, to the psychological principles upon which this lesson is founded, because it will mean a loss that you will ill afford if you fail to grasp the real reason for establishing a definite chief aim in your mind. These principles are as follows. First, every voluntary movement of the human body is caused, controlled, and directed by thought through the operation of the mind. Second, the presence of any thought or idea in your consciousness tends to produce an associated feeling and to urge you to transform that feeling into appropriate muscular action that is in perfect harmony with the nature of the thought. For example, if you think of winking your eyelid and there is no counter influences or thoughts in your mind at the time to arrest your action, the motor nerve will carry your thought from the seat of government in your brain, and appropriate or corresponding muscular action takes place immediately. Stating this principle from another angle, you choose, for example, a definite purpose as your life work, and make up your mind that you will carry out that purpose. From the very moment that you make this choice, this purpose becomes the dominating thought in your consciousness, and you are constantly on the alert for facts, information, and knowledge with which to achieve that purpose. From the time that you plant a definite purpose in your mind begins, both consciously and unconsciously, to gather and store away the material with which you are to accomplish that purpose. Desire is the factor which determines what your definite purpose in life shall be. No one can select your dominating desire for you, but once you select it yourself, it becomes your definite chief aim and occupies the spotlight of your mind until it is satisfied by transformation into reality, unless you permit it to be pushed away by conflicting desires. To emphasize the principle that I'm here trying to make clear, I believe it is not unreasonable to suggest that to be sure of successful achievement, one's definite chief aim in life should be backed up with a burning desire for its achievement. I have noticed that boys and girls who enter college and pay their way through by working seem to get more out of their schooling than do those whose expenses are paid for them. The secret of this may be found in the fact that those who are willing to work their way through are blessed with a burning desire for education, and such a desire, if the object of the desire is within reason, is practically sure of realization. Science has established, beyond the slightest room for doubt, that through the principle of autosuggestion, any deeply rooted desire saturates the entire body and mind with the nature of the desire and literally transforms the mind into a powerful magnet that will attract the object of the desire, if it be within reason. For the enlightenment of those who might not properly interpret the meaning of this statement, I will endeavor to state this principle in another way. For example, merely desiring an automobile will not cause that automobile to come rolling in. But, if there is a burning desire for an automobile, that desire will lead to the appropriate action through which an automobile may be paid for. Merely desiring freedom would never release a man who was confined in prison if it were not sufficiently strong to cause him to do something to entitle himself to freedom. These are the steps leading from desire to fulfillment. First, the burning desire. Then the crystallization of that desire into a definite purpose. Then sufficient appropriate action to achieve that purpose. Remember that these three steps are always necessary to ensure success. I once knew a very poor girl who had a burning desire for a wealthy husband, and she finally got him, but not without having transformed that desire into the development of a very attractive personality, which in turn attracted the desired husband. I once had a burning desire to be able to analyze character accurately, and that desire was so persistent and so deeply seated that it practically drove me into 10 years of research and study of men and women. George Parker makes one of the best fountain pens in the world, and despite the fact that his business is conducted from the little city of Janesville, Wisconsin, he has spread his product all the way around the globe, and he has his pen on sale in every civilized country in the world. More than 20 years ago, Mr. Parker's definite purpose was established in his mind, and that purpose was to produce the best fountain pen that money could buy. He backed that purpose with a burning desire for its realization that if you carry a fountain pen, the chances are that you have evidence in your own possession that it has brought him abundant success. You are a contractor and builder, and like men who build houses out of mere wood and brick and steel, you must draw up a set of plans after which to shape your success building. You are living in a wonderful age when the materials that go into success are plentiful and cheap. You have at your disposal, in the archives of the public libraries, the carefully compiled results of 2,000 years of research covering practically every possible line of endeavor in which one would wish to engage. If you would become a preacher, you would have at hand the entire history of what has been learned by men who have preceded you in this field. If you would become a mechanic, you have at hand the entire history of the inventions of the machines and discovery and usages of metals and things metallic in nature. If you would become a lawyer, you have at your disposal the entire history of law procedure. Through the Department of Agriculture at Washington, you have at your disposal all that has been learned about farming and agriculture. Where you may use it, you should wish to find your life work in this field. The world was never so resplendent with opportunity as it is today. On every hand, there is an ever-increasing demand for the services of the man or woman who makes a better mousetrap, or performs better stenographic service, or preaches a better sermon, or digs a better ditch, or runs a more accommodating bank. This lesson will not be completed until you shall have made your choice as to what your definite chief aim in life is to be, and then record a description of that purpose in writing, and place it where you may see it every morning when you arise and every night when you retire. Procrastination is, but why preach about it? You know that you are the hewer of your own wood and the drawer of your own water, and the shaper of your own definite chief aim in life. Therefore, why dwell upon that which you already know? A definite purpose is something that you must create for yourself. No one else will create it for you, and it will not create itself. What are you going to do about it, and when and how? Start now to analyze your desire and find out what it is that you wish. Then make up your mind to get it. Lesson 3 will point out to you the next step and show you how to proceed. Nothing is left to chance in this reading course. Every step is marked plainly. Your part is to follow the direction until you have arrived at your destination, which is represented by your definite chief aim. Make that aim clear and back it up with persistence, which does not recognize the word impossible. When you come to select your definite chief aim, just keep in mind the fact that you cannot aim too high. Also keep in mind the never-varying truth that you'll get nowhere if you start nowhere. If your aim in life is vague, your achievements will also be vague, and it might well be added very meager. Know what you want, when you want it, why you want it, and how you intend to get it. This is known to teachers and students of psychology as WWWH formula, what, when, why, and how. Read this lesson 4 times at intervals of 1 week apart. You will see much in the lesson the 4th time you read that you did not see the first time. Your success in mastering this course and in making it bring you success will depend very largely, if not entirely, upon how well you follow all the instructions it contains. Do not set up your own rules of study. Follow those laid down in the course, as they are the result of years of thoughts and experimentation. If you wish to experiment, wait until you master this course in the manner suggested by the author. You will then be in position to experiment more safely. For the present, content yourself by being the student. You will, let us hope, become the teacher as well as the student after you have followed the course until you have mastered it. If you follow the instructions laid down in this course for the guidance of its students, you can no more fail than water can run uphill above the level of its source. Instructions for applying the principles of this lesson. Through the introductory lesson of this course, you became familiar with the principle of psychology known as the mastermind. You are now ready to begin use of this principle as a means of transforming your definite chief aim into reality. It must have occurred to you that one might as well have no definite chief aim unless one has also a very definitive and practical plan for making that aim become a reality. Your first step is to decide what your major aim in life shall be. Your next step is to write out a clear, concise statement of this aim. You should be followed by a statement in writing of the plan or plans through which you intend to attain the object of your aim. Your next and final step will be the forming of an alliance with some person or persons who will cooperate with you in carrying out these plans and transforming your definite chief aim into reality. The purpose of this friendly alliance is to employ the law of the mastermind in support of your plans. The alliance should be made between yourself and those who have your highest and best interests at heart. If you are a married man, your wife should be one of the members of this alliance, providing there exists between you a normal state of confidence and sympathy. Other members of this alliance may be your mother, father, brothers, or sisters, or some close friend or friends. If you are a single person, your sweetheart, if you have one, should become a member of your alliance. This is no joke. You are now studying one of the most powerful laws of the human mind, and you will serve your own best interest by seriously and earnestly following the rules laid down in this lesson, even though you may not be sure where they will lead you. Those who join with you in the formation of a friendly alliance for the purpose of aiding you in the creation of a mastermind should sign with you your statement of the object of your definite chief aim. Every member of your alliance must be fully acquainted with the nature of your object in forming the alliance. Moreover, every member must be in hearty accord with this object and in full sympathy with you. Each member of your alliance must be supplied with a written copy of your statement of your definite chief aim. With this exception, however, you are explicitly instructed to keep the object of your chief aim to yourself. The world is full of doubting Thomases, and it will do your cause no good to have those rattle-brained people scoffing at you and your ambitions. Remember, what you need is friendly encouragement and help, not derision and doubt. If you believe in prayer, you are instructed to make your definite chief aim the object of your prayer at least once every 24 hours, and more often if convenient. If you believe there is a God who can and will aid those who are earnestly striving to be of constructive service in the world, surely you feel that you have a right to petition Him for aid in the attainment of what should be the most important thing in life to you. If those who have been invited to join your friendly alliance believe in prayer, ask them also to include the object of this alliance as part of their daily prayers. Comes now one of the most essential rules which you must follow. Arrange with one or all of the members of your friendly alliance to state to you, in the most positive and definitive terms at their command, that they know you can and will realize the object of your definite chief aim. This affirmation or statement should be made to you at least once a day, more often if possible. These steps must be followed persistently with full faith that they will lead you where you wish to go. It will not suffice to carry out these plans for a few days or a few weeks and then discontinue them. You must follow the described procedure until you attain the object of your definitive chief aim, regardless of the time required. From time to time, it may become necessary to change the plans you have adopted for the achievement of the object of your definite chief aim. Make these changes without hesitation. No human being has sufficient foresight to build plans which need no alteration or change. If any member of your family alliance loses faith in the law known as the mastermind, immediately remove that person and replace him or her with some other person. Andrew Carnegie stated to the author of this course that he had found it necessary to replace some of the members of his mastermind. In fact, he stated that practically every member of whom his alliance was originally composed had, in time, been removed and replaced with some other person who could adapt himself more loyally and enthusiastically to the spirit and object of the alliance. You cannot succeed when surrounded by disloyal and unfriendly associates, no matter what may be the object of your definite chief aim. Success is built upon loyalty, faith, sincerity, cooperation, and the other positive forces with which one must surcharge his environment. Many of the students of this course will want to form friendly alliances with those with whom they are associated professionally or in business, with the object of achieving success in their business or profession. In such cases, the same rules of procedure which have been here described should be followed. The object of your definite chief aim may be one that will benefit you individually, or it may be one that will benefit the business or profession with which you are connected. The law of the mastermind will work the same in either case. If you fail, either temporarily or permanently, in the application of this law, it will be for the reason that some member of your alliance did not enter into the spirit of the alliance with faith, loyalty, and sincerity of purpose. The last sentence is worthy of a second reading. The object of your definite chief aim should become your hobby. You should ride this hobby continuously. You should sleep with it, eat with it, play with it, work with it, live with it, and think with it. Whatever you want, you may get if you want it with sufficient intensity and keep on wanting it, providing the object wanted is one within reason and you actually believe you will get it. There is a difference, however, between merely wishing for something and actually believing you will get it. Lack of understanding of this difference has meant failure to millions of people. The doers are the believers in all walks of life. Those who believe they can achieve the object of their definite chief aim do not recognize the word impossible. Neither do they acknowledge temporary defeat. They know they are going to succeed, and if one plan fails, they quickly replace it with another plan. Every noteworthy achievement met with some sort of temporary setback before success came. Edison made more than 10,000 experiments before he succeeded in making the first talking machine record the words, "Mary had a little lamb." If there is one word with which to stand out in your mind in connection with this lesson, it is the word persistence. You now have within your possession the passkey to achievement. You have but to unlock the door to the temple of knowledge and walk in. But you must go to the temple. It will not come to you. If these laws are new to you, the going will not be easy at first. You will stumble many times, but keep moving. Very soon you will come to the brow of the mountain you have been climbing, and you will behold in the valleys below the rich estate of knowledge, which shall be rewarded for your faith and efforts. Everything has a price. There is no such possibility as something for nothing. In your experiments with the law of the mastermind, you are jockeying with nature in her highest and noblest form. Nature cannot be tricked or cheated. She will give up to you the object of your struggles only after you have paid her price, which is continuous, unyielding, persistent effort. What more could be said on this subject? You have been shown what to do, when to do it, how to do it, and why you should do it. If you will master the next lesson on self-confidence, you will then have the faith in yourself to enable you to carry out the instructions laid down for your guidance in this lesson. Verse. Masters of human destinies am I. Fame, love, and fortune on my footsteps wait. Cities and fields I walk, I penetrate. Deserts and seas remote and passing by. Hovel and mart and palace, soon or late. I knock, unbidden, once at every gate. If sleeping, wake, if feasting, rise before. I turn away, it is the hour of fate. And they who follow me reach every state. Mortals desire and conquer every foe. Save death, but those who doubt or hesitate. Condemned to failure, penury, and woe. Seek me in vain and uselessly implore. I answer not and return no more. Ingalls. End of verse. End of Lesson 2. The Law of Success, Lesson 3, Self-Confidence. You can do it if you believe you can. Before approaching the fundamental principles upon which the lesson is founded, it will be a benefit to you to keep in mind the fact that it is practical, that it brings you the discoveries of more than 25 years of research, and it has been the approval of the leading scientific men and women of the world who have tested every principle involved. Skepticism is the deadly enemy of progress and self-development. You might as well lay down this book aside and step right here as to approach this lesson with the feeling that it was written by some long-haired theorist who had never tested the principles upon which the lesson is based. Surely, this is no age for the skeptic, because it is an age in which we have seen more of nature's laws uncovered and harnessed than had been discovered in all past history of the human race. Within 3 decades, we have witnessed the mastery of the air. We have explored the ocean. We have all but annihilated distances on the earth. We have harnessed the lightning and made it turn the wheels of industry. We have made 7 blades of grass grow where but one grew before. We have instantaneous communication between the nations of the world. Truly, this is an age of illumination and unfoldment. But we have as yet barely scratched the surface of knowledge. However, when we shall have unlocked the gate that leads to the secret power, which is stored up within us, it will bring us knowledge that will make all past discoveries pale into oblivion by comparison. Thought is the most highly organized form of energy known to man. And this is an age of experimentation and research that is sure to bring us into greater understanding of that mysterious force called thought, which reposes within us. We have already found out enough about the human mind to know that a man may throw off the accumulated effects of 1,000 generations of fear through the aid of the principle of autosuggestion. We have already discovered the fact that fear is the chief reason for poverty and failure and misery that takes on 1,000 different forms. We have already discovered the fact that the man who masters fear may march on to successful achievements in practically any undertaking, despite all efforts to defeat him. The development of self-confidence starts with the elimination of this demon called fear, which sits upon a man's shoulder and whispers into his ear, "You can't do it. You are afraid to try. You are afraid of public opinion. You are afraid that you will fail. You are afraid you have not the ability." This fear demon is getting into close quarters. Science has found a deadly weapon with which to put it in flight, and this lesson on self-confidence has brought you this weapon for use in your battle with the world-old enemy of progress, fear. The six basic fears of mankind. Every person falls here to the influence of six basic fears. Under these six fears may be listed the lesser fears. The six basic or major fears here are enumerated, and the sources from which they are believed to have grown are described. The six basic fears are the fear of poverty, the fear of old age, the fear of criticism, the fear of loss of love of someone, the fear of ill health, and the fear of death. Study the list, then take inventory of your own fears and ascertain under which of the six headings you can classify them. Every human being who has reached the age of understanding is bound down to some extent by one or more of these six basic fears. As the first step in the elimination of these six evils, let us examine the sources from whence we inherited them. Physical and social heredity. All that man is, both physically and mentally, he came by through two forms of heredity. One is known as physical heredity, and the other is called social heredity. Through the law of physical hereditary, man has slowly evolved from the amoeba, a single-cell animal form, through stages of developmental corresponding to all the known animal forms now on this earth, including those which are known to have existed, but which are now extinct. Every generation through which man has passed has added to his nature something of the traits, habits, and physical appearance of that generation. Man's physical inheritance, therefore, is a heterogeneous collection of many habits and physical forms. There seems little, if any, doubt that while the six basic fears of man could not have been inherited through physical hereditary, these six basic fears being mental states of mind, and therefore not capable of transmission through physical hereditary, it is obvious that through physical hereditary, a most favorable lodging place for these six fears has been provided. For example, it is a well-known fact that the whole process of physical evolution is based upon death, destruction, pain, and cruelty, that the elements of the soil of the earth find transportation in their upward climb through evolution, based upon the death of one form of life in order that another and higher form may subsist. All vegetation lives by eating the elements of the soil and the elements of the air. All forms of animal life live by eating some other and weaker form, or some form of vegetation. The cells of all vegetation have a very high order of intelligence. The cells of all animal life likewise have a very high order of intelligence. Undoubtedly, the animal cells of a fish have learned, out of bitter experience, that a group of animal cells, known as a fish hawk, are to be greatly feared. By reason of the fact that many animal forms, including that of most men, live by eating the smaller and weaker animals, the cell intelligence of these animals, which enter into and become a part of man, brings with it the fear growing out of their experience in having been eaten alive. This theory may seem to be far-fetched, and in fact it may not be true, but it is at least a logical theory if it is nothing more. The author makes no particular point of this theory, nor does he insist that it accounts for any of the six basic fears. There is another and much more better explanation of the source of these fears, which we will proceed to examine, beginning with a description of social heredity. By far the most important part of man's makeup comes to him through the law of social heredity. This term having reference to the methods by which one generation imposes upon the minds of the generation under its immediate control the superstitions, beliefs, legends, and ideas which it in turn inherited from the generation preceding. The term social heredity should be understood to mean any and all sources through which a person acquires knowledge, such as schooling of religious and all other natures, reading, word of mouth, conversation, storytelling, and all manner of thought, inspiration, coming from what is generally accepted as one's personal experience. Through the operation of the law of social heredity, anyone having control of the mind of a child may, through intense teaching, plant in that child's mind any idea, whether false or true, in such a manner that the child accepts it as true, and it becomes as much a part of the child's personality as any cell or organ of its physical body, and just as hard to change in its nature. It is through the law of social heredity that the religionist plants in the child mind dogmas and creeds and religious ceremonies too numerous to describe. Holding these ideas before the mind until the mind accepts them and forever seals them as a part of its irrevocable belief. The mind of a child which has not come into the age of general understanding, during an average period covering, let us say, the first 2 years of its life, is plastic, open, clean, and free. Any idea planted in such a mind by one in whom the child has confidence takes root and grows, so to speak, in such a manner that it never can be eradicated or wiped out, no matter how opposed to logic or reason that idea may be. Many religionists claim that they can so deeply implant the tenets of their religion in the mind of a child that there never can be room in that mind for any other religion, either in whole or in part. The claims are not greatly overdrawn. With this explanation of the manner in which the law of social heredity operates, the student will be ready to examine the sources from which man inherits the six basic fears. Moreover, any student, except those who have not yet grown big enough to examine truth that steps upon the petcorns of their own superstition, may check the soundness of the principle of social heredity as it is here applied to the six basic fears, without going outside of his or her own personal experience. Fortunately, practically the entire mass of evidence submitted in this lesson is of such a nature that all who sincerely seek the truth may ascertain for themselves whether the evidence is sound or not. For the moment at least, lay aside your prejudices and preconceived ideas. You may always go back and pick them up again, you know. While we study the origin and nature of man's six worst enemies, the six basic fears, beginning with the fear of poverty. It requires courage to tell the truth about the origin of this fear, and still greater courage, perhaps, to accept the truth after it has been told. The fear of poverty grew out of man's inherent tendency to prey upon his fellow man's economic. Nearly all forms of lower animals have instinct, but appear not to have the power to reason and think. Therefore, they prey upon one another physically. Man, with his superior sense of intuition, thought, and reason, does not eat his fellow man bodily. He gets more satisfaction out of eating them financially. Of all the ages of the world in which we know anything, the age in which we live seems to be the age of money worship. A man is considered less than the dust of the earth unless he can display a fat bank account. Nothing brings man so much suffering and humiliation as does poverty. No wonder man fears poverty. Through a long line of inherited experiences with the man-animal, man has learned, for certain, that this animal cannot always be trusted where matters of money and other evidence of earthly possessions are concerned. Many marriages have their beginning, and oftentimes their ending, solely on the basis of the wealth possessed by one or both of the contracting parties. It is no wonder that the divorce courts are busy. Society could quite probably be spelled society because it is so inseparably associated with the dollar mark. So eager is man to possess wealth that he will acquire it whatever manner he can, through legal methods if possible, through other methods if necessary. The fear of poverty is a terrible thing. A man may commit murder, engage in robbery, rape, and all other manner of violation of the rights of others, and still regain a high station in the minds of his fellow men, providing always that he does not lose his wealth. Poverty, therefore, is a crime and unforgivable sin, as it were. No wonder man fears it. Every statute book in the world bears evidence that the fear of poverty is one of the six basic fears of mankind. For in every such book of laws may be found various and sundry laws intended to protect the weak from the strong. To spend time trying to prove either